He would never have believed it before. Right now, he wants to pin her up against the wall and yell at her to stop lying to him and to tell him the truth. But he doesn't. Instead, he turns away from her and leaves the room. He can't get past the suspicion that she remembers what happened that night. He can't believe how hurt he is, how manipulated he feels. And yet, he's still in love with her. How much easier all this would be if he wasn't. Bridget sits alone in the dark, her knitting idle in her lap. She hasn't bothered to turn on the lights. Bob is out at a visitation again tonight. That's the funeral business for you. Lots of euphemisms. She knows other women whose husbands are in business or the professions, who sometimes accompany their husbands to events. They get a new dress, new shoes. But those are dinners and parties and so on. Not visitations for grieving families, with an open casket at one end of the room and the overpowering scent and sight of flowers everywhere. No thank you. She's begun to dislike flowers, especially flower arrangements, particularly funeral arrangements. She used to like to get flowers from her husband on their anniversary, but after a few years she told Bob to please not bother. This was because she began to suspect him of recycling flowers from the funeral home. She didn't actually accuse him of it, and she didn't know for sure, but it seemed like the kind of thing he would do. He's a bit of a cheapskate with the little things. He hadn't balked at the cost of the fertility treatments, though. What she would have loved was for him to take her away for a few days, to Venice or Paris, somewhere full of life, away from the funeral business or whatever it is that keeps him so busy. But he's always insisted that he couldn't stay away for that long. So now she gets an uninspired pair of earrings once a year that she has no occasion to wear. It's not like they can't afford to travel. Cruikshank Funeral Homes has expanded, and they now have 3 different funeral homes in Upper New York State, and Bob's busier than ever. But she isn't. She could have worked for Bob in some capacity, but when he suggested it, she said she'd rather stick pins in her eyes. He'd been offended by that. The arduous fertility treatments for which she'd quit her managerial job hadn't worked. And now, except for her knitting blog, her days are rather empty. She has her hopes pinned on adoption. She worries that Bob's line of work will hurt them in their application. But it's not as if they live in the funeral home. They're a normal couple with a normal home. The business is completely separate. They don't even talk about it much. He knows she hates to hear about it. What really annoys her is that when they were first married, he was selling insurance, which was completely respectable. But he was entrepreneurial, and the opportunity came up. It's profitable. She can't deny that. She just wishes Bob was successful at something else. She looks intently across the street at number 24, Karen and Tom's house. She wonders what Tom's thinking after her phone call earlier today. Does he believe, as she does, that Karen is hiding something about her past? It has always puzzled her that Karen is so guarded with her, given that Karen tells Bridget that she is her best friend. Bridget's efforts to draw Karen into greater intimacy have always failed. And Tom. Each night, Bridget sees the light on in his office upstairs at the front of the house. He works too hard. Like Bob. But at least when he works nights, he works at home. Karen isn't sitting alone in the house every evening like she is. Maybe she should take them over a plate of brownies. As it happens, she'd baked some brownies this afternoon. She doesn't want to eat them all herself. And it's not that late. Her mind made up, she runs upstairs to change. She brushes her shoulder-length brown hair, parted in the middle, puts on some red lipstick, and looks appraisingly in the mirror. she practices her most charming smile, the one that makes her eyes light up, and then grabs the brownies from the kitchen. Chapter 19. Karen's in the kitchen when she hears the doorbell. She freezes. When it rings again, she still doesn't move. She can hear Tom stirring upstairs. He's probably wondering why she's not getting it. When it rings a third time, she reluctantly leaves the kitchen to answer it. Her eyes meet Tom's as he's coming down the stairs. He stops halfway down. She can sense the uneasiness radiating off him. She feels an uneasiness of her own as she opens the door. It's Detective Rasbach and his sidekick, the other detective whose name she can't remember. Her mouth has gone dry. She tells herself to be calm. She reminds herself that she has a lawyer. She remembers his card in her wallet. She can reach him if she has to. Karen wants to slam the door in the detective's face. "May we come in, Mrs. Krupp?" Rasbach asks politely. She sees him flick a glance toward her husband, who's still standing like a sentry on the stairs. She thinks about it. She has only a second or two to make the right decision. Calvin has told her not to talk to the police, but she's afraid that if she sends them away, they will come back with an arrest warrant. She hears Tom walk down the rest of the stairs and come up behind her. "What do you want?" he says to the detective, a little aggressively. "I'd rather not do this on the doorstep," Rasbach answers pleasantly. Karen pulls the door open wide and allows the two detectives to enter the house, avoiding Tom's eye. They end up in the living room like before. "Please sit down," Karen says. She steals a glance at Tom now, and is alarmed by what she sees written on his face. He doesn't know how to dissemble. And right now, he looks like he's expecting his world to end. There's a pregnant silence before anyone speaks. Rasbach takes his time. She can't let it get to her. She waits him out. At last, Rasbach begins. "Have you remembered anything about the evening of your accident?" he asks Karen. "No," she says politely. After a pause, she adds, "Apparently that's not unusual in these kinds of cases." And then she thinks that perhaps she shouldn't have said that. It sounds like she's read it out of a book.
"I see," the detective says mildly. "Can I ask, just out of curiosity, what efforts you're making to regain your memory?"
"Pardon me?" Karen says at the unexpected question. She shifts in her seat.
"It seems to me that if you couldn't remember what happened that night, you'd be making some attempt to do something about it," Rasbach says.
"Like what?" she says. She crosses her arms. "I can't just take a pill and get my memory back."
"Are you seeing anyone about it?"
"No."
"Why not?"
"Because I don't think it will help. My memory will come back in its own good time."
"That's what you believe."
"That's what my doctor said." She knows she sounds defensive. She takes a deep, quiet breath. The truth is, she hasn't dared to see a specialist, such as a hypnotist, because she can't risk anyone else hearing what might have happened that night. She needs to uncover this on her own. He changes tack.
"We know that you left the house alone the night of the accident. We have witnesses who saw you leave the house."
"Okay," she says. She feels Tom glance sharply at her. Rasbach says,
"We also know that you received a phone call that night at 8:17 p.m.
"Did I?" she says.
"Yes, you did. On your landline. We've looked at your phone records," Rasbach says. "Are you allowed to do that?" Tom asks. "Yes, we are," Rasbach says. "Or we wouldn't have done it.
We got a subpoena." He turns his attention back to her.
"Who do you think might have called you at that time?"
"I have no idea."
"No idea," Rasbach repeats. Tom blurts out, as if he can't stand the tension any longer, "You obviously know who called her, so why don't you stop playing games and tell us?" Rasbach glances at her husband. "We don't actually know who called," he says. "The call was made from a disposable cell phone. We can't trace that kind of call." Then Rasbach leans forward in his chair toward her. A little ominously, she thinks. "But I imagine you know that." Karen feels the eyes of the two detectives and her husband on her at this new information. Her heart is beating double time now. "That's a bit out of the ordinary," Rasbach continues. "Don't you think?" She thinks about the card in her wallet. It was a mistake to let them in. "Interesting that the call came on the home line, rather than on your cell," the detective says. She stares at him, but says nothing. What can she possibly say? "Perhaps the call wasn't meant for you at all," Rasbach says. This suggestion surprises her. Rasbach turns back to Tom, who looks as confused by this as she is. "What do you mean?" Tom asks. Rasbach says, "I mean, maybe the call was meant for you, and she took it instead." "What?" Tom says, obviously taken aback. "The call came at 8:17. Aren't you usually home by that time?" the detective asks. Karen watches Rasbach, relieved to have their focus shift away from her and who called her from that burner phone, if even for a moment. Let them waste their time on Tom, she thinks. They won't find anything there. She feels herself start to relax, just a little bit. They obviously don't really know anything. They're fishing. They'll be leaving soon with nothing more than what they came with. "Yes, I'm usually home by 8 or earlier, but I've been very busy at work lately," Tom says defensively. The detective waits. "What, you think someone called me from an untraceable cell phone?" "It's possible," Rasbach says. "That's ridiculous," Tom protests. When Rasbach remains silent, simply watching him with his sharp blue eyes, Tom says, "You think someone called me from an untraceable cell phone and my wife took the call and ran out of the house? Why would she do that?" Karen watches Tom and Rasbach, surprised at where this is going. "Yes. Why?" Rasbach asks, and waits quietly. Tom loses patience. "Detectives, I'm afraid you're wasting your time, not to mention ours. Maybe you should go." "Have you got something to hide, Mr. Krupp?" Rasbach asks, as if he already knows the answer. Karen swivels her startled eyes to her husband's face. Bridget hesitates on her own doorstep, brownies in hand, when she sees the car on the street in front of the Krupp's house. She knows that car. Those two detectives are there again. Bridget is dying to know what's going on. She decides to slip around to the back of the house and leave the brownies just inside the back door. She doesn't want to bother anybody. It's a hot night, and as she hoped, the sliding glass doors are open to let in the breeze. Only the screen door is closed. If she stands very still, in the dark, she may be able to hear what they're saying in the living room, especially if she quietly opens the door to set the brownies down, maybe just inside, on the kitchen table. Chapter 20. Tom feels an ugly red flush creep up his neck to his face. He's angry with the detective, barging into their home with a lot of sly accusations. He doesn't have to put up with it. "No, detective," Tom says, "I don't have anything to hide."
"If you say so," Rasbach says after a moment.
"Why would you even suggest such a thing?" Tom asks, and then immediately wishes he hadn't. Rasbach regards him carefully.
"Because we've been looking at the timeline for the night of the accident. Your wife had her accident, not far from the scene of the murder, at approximately 8:45 p.m. You told the 911 operator that night that you drove home from work and arrived home at about 9:20 and found your wife missing, the doors unlocked, and the lights on. Yes, Tom says. Razbach pauses for a moment and then says, We spoke to security at your office, and they said you left at 8:20. It's only about a 15-minute drive from your office to here. So, where were you for that hour? That's a rather critical time in this investigation, from 8:20 to 9:20 or thereabouts. Tom suddenly feels lightheaded. Karen looks at him, clearly shocked, and he looks away. He can feel himself sweating, can feel the moisture staining his shirt beneath his sleeves. For that matter, Razbach adds, we only have your word for it that you were home at 9:20. You didn't start calling your wife's friends until... He looks at his notes. 9:40, I believe. And then you called 911 shortly after that. He waits, but Tom says nothing. So where were you? I was driving around, Tom answers, faltering. You were driving around for an extra 45 minutes, Razbach says, his eyes like steel. Why? Tom wants to reach for the other man's throat. Instead, he takes a deep breath and tries to steady himself. I needed to think, to clear my mind. I'd had a long day. You didn't want to get home to your wife. Tom looks at the detective, wonders what he knows, and in that moment hates the man's guts, his smoothness, his composure, his sly innuendo. Yes, of course I did, Tom snaps, but driving helps clear my mind. It helps me relax. I have a very stressful job. It sounds lame, even to him. Tom sees Razbach's eyebrows go up. It's something the detective does, for effect, and Tom despises him for it. Did you stop anywhere? Anyone see you? Tom starts to shake his head, and then hesitates and says, I stopped for a few minutes to sit at one of the picnic tables along the river, for some fresh air. I don't think anyone saw me. You remember where, exactly? Tom tries to think. Near the foot of Branscombe, I think. The parking lot's there. He can't bring himself to look at Karen. Razbach jots it down, gives him a last penetrating look, and stands up, putting his notebook away. Finally, Tom thinks, they're leaving. They've done enough damage for one night. Karen shows the detectives out, while Tom remains sitting in the living room, staring at the floor, preparing to face his wife. Karen knows Tom doesn't like driving. It doesn't relax him. If anything, it stresses him out. She feels the ground shifting beneath her feet. She has to ask him. So why were you driving around for an hour that night? Why did you drive your car into a pole? He flashes back. She opens her mouth in surprise. Tom says abruptly, I'm going out. She watches him leave. She flinches when he slams the door behind him. What was Tom doing that night? That detective is no fool. Is it possible that Tom's lying to her? That he's hiding something from her? Troubled, she wanders into the kitchen to get some ice water and immediately spots a plate of brownies on the table. She stops in her tracks. She recognizes the plate. It's Brigid's. Brigid was here and left her signature brownies. The brownies weren't there before the detectives arrived. She must have left them on the kitchen table while they were talking to Tom and her in the living room. Karen feels a chill. Could she have overheard anything? She hates how out of control everything is getting. She closes her eyes, takes a deep breath,
and forces herself to relax. She'll call Bridget tomorrow and thank her for the brownies. She can trust Bridget. She'll talk to her and find out how much she heard. Karen fills her glass with water from the refrigerator and takes the plate of brownies with her into the living room and waits for Tom to return. What is he hiding? Tom has always been an open book. She can't believe that he is keeping something from her. Where could he have been for that hour? And why doesn't he want to tell her? Tom gets into his car and drives to a neighborhood bar, the kind of place that local teams go to for a beer after a friendly baseball game. He needs to get his head together. He slides into an empty booth, orders a beer, and slumps over it. He doesn't want to talk to anyone. He's got himself into a bit of a mess. In fact, the more he thinks about it, the messier it looks. He didn't want to tell the detectives what he was doing that night, not in front of Karen, because he knows how it's going to look. Now it will all come out. He was supposed to meet Bridget that night, at 8:30 at their spot by the river, at that quiet place between downtown and the suburbs, where the path along the river is less crowded and trees provide a bit of privacy. It's where they used to sometimes meet, when they were having their short, misguided, and messy affair. She had called him that day, the day of the accident, at his office, and asked him to meet her. She wouldn't tell him why. But she stood him up that night. He waited over half an hour, in the dark, but she didn't show. He still doesn't know why Bridget wanted to meet him. When he asked her, in that terse first phone call when he was looking for Karen, what she'd wanted and why she'd stood him up, she'd brushed him off, saying her sister had had some kind of crisis and that it could wait. He was more worried about finding Karen anyway. He knows he should have told Karen about him and Bridget. Now he'll have to tell the detectives, and it will look as if he were meeting Bridget that night because he wanted to, and keeping it a secret from Karen. He knows he should tell Karen now, tonight, tell her everything. But he's not in a confiding mood. Maybe he'd feel more like telling her the truth if she went first. When Tom returns home, his wife eyes him cautiously. They're wary of each other now. "Do you want one?" Karen asks him after a moment, pointing to the brownies on the coffee table. "Where did those come from?" Tom asks as he sits down. "They look like Bridget's. They taste like hers, too." "Was she just here?" Tom asks.
"She must have been."
Tom looks at her questioningly.
"What do you mean?"
"When you left, I went into the kitchen and they were sitting on the table."
"What?" Tom says. "When did she put them there?"
"I assume when we were in here talking to the detectives," Karen says.
"Shit," Tom says uneasily.
"I'll talk to her tomorrow. Try to explain." Tom rubs a hand over his face.
"How are you going to explain two detectives in our living room asking questions about a murder investigation?"
Karen doesn't even look at him. She says, "I'll tell her the truth. There was a murder that night near where I had my accident. Nothing to do with me. But the police are desperate and they don't have any leads. They'll give up when they don't find anything," she says.
She seems to be forgetting about the gloves, Tom thinks, and the tire tracks, and the mysterious phone call. She's pretending to have a confidence that she can't possibly really feel.
There's a long, fraught silence between them. Finally, Tom says,
"Maybe you should see a doctor."
"Why?" Her voice is sharp.
"Like the detective said, it's not like you're actually doing anything to try to get your memory back."
She stares at him now, but he doesn't look away.
"Maybe you should."
"What's a doctor going to do?" she says coldly.
"I don't know," Tom answers. "Maybe you could try hypnosis."
He's pushing her.
goading her. Let's find out what happened that night. I really want to know. Do you?
She gives a forced laugh. I'm not doing hypnosis. That's ridiculous.
Is it?
He's challenging her, and he can tell she doesn't like it.
She gets up and leaves the room, taking the plate of brownies back into the kitchen. Tom remains alone on the living room sofa, crushed by a devastating loneliness. He hears the door in the kitchen slide open and then close again. She's gone out.
Chapter 21. Karen closes the door behind her and stands briefly on the back patio. She has to fight the urge to cry. None of this was supposed to happen. She's losing Tom. She sits down in one of the wicker chairs, hoping Tom will join her. But he doesn't, and she feels sad, and lonely, and angry, and frightened. And this terrible suspicion she suddenly feels. Where was Tom for that hour? What is he not telling her? How she wishes she could remember what happened that night. What had she done? She wants to escape the tension of the house with her and Tom in it. She rises from the chair, walks across the back of the house and down the driveway. Maybe she should drop in on Bridget. But she can't face talking to Bridget right now. She walks briskly down the sidewalk, away from the house. She needs to think. Karen's gone out, and Tom's home alone. Bridget had seen him return just a few minutes ago. Something's definitely up. Bridget steps outside and quickly crosses the street. She doesn't know how long she has before Karen returns. She climbs the steps and knocks on the front door. He doesn't answer right away. She knocks again. Finally, Tom yanks open the door, looking tired and distraught. There are hollows in his handsome face that didn't used to be there. He looks ashen. Hi, she says.
Hi, Tom says. His left hand remains on the edge of the door, as if he's about to close it again at any moment. Karen's not home. She's just gone out for a bit.
I know, Bridget says. I saw her go down the street. She hesitates. I was hoping to get you alone, actually, for a minute.
She slips past him into the living room. Now he either has to ask her to leave or close the door behind her. She doesn't think he's going to ask her to leave.
I wanted to ask you about Karen,
Bridget says, turning around to face him.
How's she doing? Is she all right?
Tom looks back at her coldly. She's getting better.
She seemed really rattled when I was here the other day, Bridget says, about the glass. That wasn't like her at all.
Tom nods. It's just... there's a lot going on right now.
I know, Bridget says. I saw that those detectives were here again a little while ago.
She pauses. When Tom doesn't say anything, she asks,
What did they want?
Tom says tightly, They wanted to see if she remembers anything about the accident yet, but she doesn't. She says she doesn't know what happened that night.
And you believe her?
Bridget says. Of course I believe her, Tom says, bristling.
But the police don't?
I don't know what the police believe. Nothing they say makes any sense.
Bridget eyes him carefully. Their earlier phone conversation about Karen hangs between them. She can't resist bringing it up. She says, The day of the accident, the reason I called you and asked you to meet me, it was to tell you about the man snooping around, hinting about Karen's past. I thought if I tried to tell you over the phone, you'd hang up on me. But then my sister called and
I don't want to talk about it, Tom says abruptly.
There's an awkward silence.
Then Tom says, Maybe you should try Karen again in the morning.
She nods. Sure, I'll call on her then. She adds, You look exhausted, Tom.
He runs a hand through his hair and says,
"That's because I am exhausted."
"If there's anything I can do to help," Bridget says, and puts her hand lightly on his arm, "just ask."
"Thanks," Tom says stiffly, "but I'll be fine."
She can feel the warmth of his bare forearm under her hand. He moves away from her, breaking the contact. "Good night," she says, and turns to go back down the stairs to go home. She looks across the lawn and the street to her own house, empty and almost entirely in darkness, except for the light over the front door. Tom closes the door behind Bridget with relief, then rests his body against it and feels himself sag with fatigue. He always feels awkward and tense around Bridget. He dislikes the close friendship that has developed between Bridget and his wife. He knows it's selfish of him. He drifts into the living room, wondering what Bridget is thinking. She recognized the detectives. Detectives don't investigate car accidents. She obviously suspects something more is going on. And he knows she has questions about Karen's past. He wishes she hadn't shared her suspicions with him. If what Bridget suspects is true, then Karen's deceptive behavior started long before the night of the accident. And yet, it's so hard to believe. He remembers all the happy times they've had together, holding hands walking through the woods in the fall, having coffee together in the backyard in summer, nestled in bed under the covers in winter. He's always felt completely in love with her, always believed that they were completely committed to each other. But now? Now he doesn't know what he believes. If she really can't remember, why wouldn't she make an effort to get her memory back, like the detective said? Tom goes into the kitchen and reaches into a cupboard for a bottle of whiskey. There's a lot of liquor left over from their wedding party almost 2 years ago. He rarely has anything more than a beer or a glass of wine with dinner. Now he pours himself a stiff one and waits for his wife. Chapter 22. Karen walks quickly, as skittish as a cat. She's breathing rapidly from a combination of exertion and emotion. She feels as if she's about to crack. She's been living in fear for too long. Karen thinks about the first time she came home from work and felt that things were not exactly as she'd left them. She noticed that the novel she'd been reading the night before was placed to the left of her bedside table lamp. She was sure she'd put it down to the right of the lamp, on the side nearest the bed, just before she'd gone to sleep. She wouldn't have placed it on the other side of the lamp. She stood there staring at it in disbelief. Anxiously, she scanned the rest of the room. At first glance, everything looked the way it should. But when she opened her underwear drawer, it was untidy, as if someone had rummaged through her panties and bras. She knew that someone had. She stood perfectly still, looking down at her drawer, holding her breath. She told herself it was impossible that someone had been in the house, going through her dresser. Perhaps she'd been rushed that morning, sloppy. But she knew she hadn't been. It had just been a regular day. She hadn't mentioned it to Tom. Then there was the day she came home, not long afterward, and went into the bedroom to change. She'd made the bed in the morning, as she always did. She always made the bed the way she'd learned to do it when she was a young woman working as a chambermaid in a 5-star hotel, all tight corners and firm smoothness. She was taking off her earrings, saw the bed reflected in the dresser mirror, and froze. Then she spun around and stared. She could see, faintly, the impression of a body on top of the pale green bedspread, as if someone had lain down on top of the bed and then smoothed it out, carelessly, afterward. It gave her a fright. She knew she wasn't imagining it. Tom left for work every day before she tidied up and made the bed. She was so rattled that she called Tom at the office and asked him if he'd been home during the day. He hadn't. She told him she'd found a window open that she thought she'd closed before she left for work, but that she must have forgotten to close it. He didn't seem to give it another thought. After that, she started taking pictures in each room of the house on her cell phone before she left for work each day, and comparing them to how she found things when she got home. She always left for work after Tom and got home before him. They had no cleaning lady, no pets. So if things weren't exactly as she left them... The last time had been just a few days before the accident. She could sense that someone had been in the house. She could feel it somehow. She went through the house with her cell phone in her hand, comparing the pictures on her phone with what she saw in the rooms in front of her. Everything was as it should be. Still, she felt certain someone had been there. She was starting to relax until she got to the office upstairs. She stared down at Tom's desk. She thumbed through the pictures on her phone till she got to that morning's pictures of the office. Tom's open agenda wasn't in the same place on his blotter. It was about 6 inches higher on the blotter than before. She stared at the photo, and then at the desk. There was no doubt about it. Someone had been here, inside their house. Someone had been in their house, going through their things, lying on their bed. She never told Tom. And now she knows who it was. It had been him, all along. He'd been in their house, coming and going at will, watching and waiting. The thought of it makes her ill. But now he's dead. The hideous pictures of the corpse invade her mind, and she tries to push them out again. That time with the glass on the counter, she must have been mistaken. Her raw nerves had made her panic. The glass must have been there before, and she'd just forgotten, probably because of the concussion. Her fears now are all centered on that damned detective. Her heart thuds in her chest, and she walks faster, toward home. She enters the house, anxious to get inside. She closes the door firmly behind her and locks it. She turns around and sees Tom watching her intently from the living room. He's standing by the fireplace, holding a whiskey in his right hand. "Can you pour me one of those?" she says. She's done with the pain meds, and she needs a drink.
"Sure."
She follows him to the kitchen. As he reaches up in the cupboard for the bottle, she watches him. She wishes they could get past this mistrust, this tension. She wonders if that will ever be possible now. He turns and hands her a short glass with a shot of whiskey, neat. "Thanks," she says. She takes a sip and immediately feels the liquor burn down her throat, steadying her a little.
"Where have you been?" Tom asks.
He's trying so hard to keep any hint of confrontation out of his voice now that he doesn't sound natural at all. Gone is the light-hearted, unthinkingly happy man she married. The man with a quick laugh, the spontaneous hugs and kisses. She's changed him. "I went for a walk," she says, her voice neutral. He nods, as if it's perfectly natural for her to go for a walk alone after dark, without him. "It's like we're perfect strangers," Karen thinks, taking another sip of whiskey.
"Bridget dropped by,"
Tom says. He's leaning against the counter, facing her. Karen's heart tightens.
"She did. What did she say? Did she overhear anything?" Karen asks.
"She must have," Tom says irritably.
"But you didn't ask?"
"You can ask her tomorrow," Tom says. "Better that you ask her anyway."
She nods. She looks at her husband, and her heart lurches as his eyes slide away. They both need to know what her mind has blocked out. "Tom," she says hesitantly, "do you want to drive me down there? To where they found the body?"
"What, now?" Tom says, caught off guard.
"Why not?" She remembers how he goaded her, how he accused her of not doing anything to get her memory back. She's offering to do something about it now. If he only knew how desperate she was to know what happened that night. "Maybe it will help me remember." She knows the address. She clipped it out of the newspaper.
"All right,"
Tom says, putting down his drink. He picks up his keys on his way out the door, and she follows him. Chapter 23. As they leave their own familiar neighborhood behind and head south, Karen feels more and more uncomfortable. It feels like looking for trouble, driving a Lexus through these decaying streets. "See, I'm trying," she wants to say to him, but she doesn't. She watches out the window at the depressing view, trying to remember, but nothing is coming back to her.
"I think that's it," Tom says, pulling into a strip mall's empty parking lot and looking across the street at the derelict restaurant that they've heard so much about.
They sit in the darkness, looking at the ugly, boarded-up building. She doesn't want to get out of the car in this neighborhood. Now she just wants to go home. Nothing looks familiar. She's never seen this place before. She's never been here. She starts to tremble.
"Let's go take a look, shall we?" Tom says, a little callously.
She'd never intended to get out of the car. She just meant to see the place from a distance. She shrinks back into her seat.
"I don't want to."
He gets out of the car anyway. She has no choice but to follow him. She doesn't want to sit here alone. She gets out of the car and closes her door angrily. She has to walk quickly to catch up with him as he crosses the street and strides toward the restaurant on the opposite side. She looks around nervously, but there's no one else in sight. Together, they stand in front of the building, saying nothing. She can feel his recrimination in the set of his shoulders, the cold expression on his face. He knows she was here, and he can't forgive her for it. Without speaking, Tom heads around the side of the building toward the back. She follows him, stumbling a little in the dark because she feels unsteady on her feet. She's breathing quickly, and it's making her lightheaded. She feels a terrible fear. But she recognizes nothing. She remembers nothing. At the back, the yellow police tape is mostly still up, but dragging a bit in places, moving in the breeze.
"Is this helping at all?" Tom asks, turning to her.
She shakes her head. She knows she looks frightened.
"Let's go back, Tom," she says.
He ignores her.
"Let's go in."
She hates him for challenging her this way, for not caring how frightened she is. She thinks about turning back and making her own way to the car. If she had her keys with her, she'd drive away and leave him here. Instead, her anger gives her the courage to go after him under the police tape and up to the back door. He pushes it with one elbow. Surprisingly, it opens. She supposes that the police are done here and have left things as they found them. Tom walks in ahead of her. There's light coming from the streetlight out front, slanting in through a break in the boarded-up window, enough light to see the interior fairly well. There's a dark stain on the floor where the body must have been, and a lingering, repellent odor, the smell of a rotting animal. She stops, rigid, staring at the stain. Her hand goes involuntarily to her mouth, as if she might gag. Tom looks back at her.
"Anything?"
he says.
"I've had enough," she says,
and turns and stumbles out of the restaurant. Once outside, she bends forward and gulps deep breaths of fresh air. When she lifts her head again,
She's looking at a parking lot a short distance away. Tom comes up beside her and looks in the same direction.
I think that's where they found the tire tracks and the gloves, Tom says, and walks toward the parking lot.
She watches him.
He turns around after a few paces and says, Coming?
No. I'm going back to the car. She starts walking without looking at him. All this has done is frightened her. It hasn't helped her remember, and her efforts haven't won her any goodwill or sympathy from Tom either.
Tom watches Karen head back toward the strip mall. She's upset with him, but he doesn't care. It even gives him a nasty sort of satisfaction. After all, this is all her fault.
He sees her cross the street and wait beside the car.
He has the keys, and she can't get in.
He makes a show of looking around the parking lot, wondering where exactly her car had been parked, where the police had found their gloves. He takes his time, but he keeps an eye on her to make sure she's all right, standing alone beside an expensive car. Finally, he returns to her, unlocks the car, and drives them silently home.
He reflects that all this little excursion has done is to further show the fault lines in their already fractured relationship.
When they arrive home, it's late. Tom tosses his keys on the table inside the door and says,
I'm tired. I think I'll go up to bed.
He turns away from her and heads upstairs. And with each step he takes, his despair deepens. Bob lets himself into the house quietly. He peeks into the living room, where he knows he'll find Bridget sitting in the dark. He knows she isn't waiting up for him. She used to, but she's not interested in him anymore. All she's interested in is the damn neighbors. He's hurting, too. He could still love her, if she could only move on from her grief about their childlessness. It's torn them apart, and it's affecting her emotional health. She's always been the emotional one. He's always been the steady one, her rock. But now he doesn't know what to do. He knows how to talk to grieving families. He does it all day long. He's quite good at it. But he has failed miserably at it at home. He can't help his wife deal with her feelings of loss, or deal properly with his own.
Bridget, he says softly, seeing the outline of her head dark against the back of the chair. For a moment, she is so still that he thinks she might be asleep.
He takes a few more steps into the living room. When she speaks, it startles him.
Hi, she says.
Shouldn't you go to bed?
Bob asks, approaching and looking down at her with concern. She doesn't even raise her eyes to look at him. They are fixed on the house across the street.
Those detectives were back tonight, talking to Karen and Tom, she says.
Bob doesn't know what the hell's going on with Karen and Tom Krupp. She seems to be in some kind of trouble. He doesn't really know them, but he knows Bridget and Karen are close.
What's going on, do you think?
Bridget shakes her head.
I don't know.
Has Karen remembered anything yet?
No.
She finally turns to look at him.
I made brownies. Do you want one?
Karen watches Tom's retreating back, her heart sinking with each step he takes away from her. Still trembling, she goes into the kitchen and pours herself another shot of whiskey. Then she carries it into the living room and slumps onto the sofa, cradling it in her unsteady hands. She gulps the alcohol and stares at a blank spot on the wall. For how long, she has no idea. It's perfectly quiet. Suddenly, she hears the phone ring in the kitchen. Her entire body stiffens. The phone stops on the second ring. Tom must have picked it up in the bedroom. But all at once, she's remembering that other phone call. She closes her eyes. She's back in the kitchen, making a salad, slicing a tomato on the cutting board. She expected Tom home soon.
She was looking forward to seeing him. When the phone rang, she thought it might be him, saying he was going to be even later than expected. But it wasn't Tom. It's coming back to her now, and she concentrates. She wants to know. It was a voice she hadn't heard in almost 3 years, one she thought she'd never hear again. She'd know that voice anywhere.
"Hello, Georgina."
Her heart began to pound. Her mouth went dry. She considered ending the call without uttering a word, but that would be like a young child crouching and closing her eyes tightly, thinking no one could see her. She couldn't hang up the phone. She couldn't just close her eyes. He'd found her. She already knew he'd found her. He'd been in her house. She'd been waiting, in plain view, trying to pretend this wasn't going to happen. And now it was. She'd fled that life, begun over as someone else. She'd found unexpected happiness with Tom. And with one phone call, she could feel her new life shattering into a million jagged pieces. He gave her the address of an abandoned restaurant in a neighborhood she would never have set foot in otherwise. Then Karen hung up the phone. All she could think about was protecting herself and not letting anyone destroy what she now had with Tom. She saw the pink gloves sitting on the counter and grabbed them. She retrieved her gun from its hiding place in the furnace room, the gun that Tom knew nothing about, putting it with the gloves in a cloth bag. Then she swiped her car keys off the table and flew down the steps, not even thinking about locking the door or leaving a note for Tom. She drove, her hands tight around the steering wheel, staying just within the speed limit, her mind blank. For a moment, everything stops. Karen can't remember what happened next. She takes another gulp of whiskey, tries to relax. And then suddenly she remembers parking the car in that lot. She remembers pulling the gloves out of the cloth bag and slipping them on. They looked absurd. She took the gun out of the bag. She was trembling. She looked around to see if anyone was watching. The place was deserted. And then got out of the car and walked nervously in the dark toward the back of the building where he'd told her to go. When she got there, the door was already slightly ajar, and she pushed it open with her gloved fingers. But here, her memory fails her. She waits. She tries to force it, but nothing will come. She fights tears of frustration. She still doesn't know what happened inside that restaurant. She doesn't know how he was killed. She must know what happened. How can she decide what to do if she doesn't know the truth? But she can see nothing more. What she saw tonight with Tom, it's all terribly familiar to her now. She can't bear to think about it anymore. She finishes her drink in one big gulp, puts the glass down on the coffee table, and buries her face in her hands. Chapter 24. The next morning, Tom has gone to work, and Karen's alone in the house. She feels the walls closing in on her. She sits in the kitchen, ignoring the cup of coffee in front of her, her entire body tense. She's terrified that Razbach will be back. In the meantime, she imagines him scurrying around, digging, finding out things. Finding out things about her. Finding out who the dead man is. Then it's just a matter of time. Karen hasn't told Tom what she now remembers. She can't. She has to think, figure out a way through this. But her normally sharp mind, so good at planning, isn't working so well right now. Perhaps it's because of the concussion. She escaped before. She got away from him, away from Las Vegas, started over.
She told him that she was going sightseeing that day, to the Hoover Dam, just outside of Vegas. The night before, she picked up the second-hand car she'd bought with cash a few weeks earlier. She'd arranged to leave it with the dealer until she needed it. She'd used her new ID, obtained through someone she hired online, to register the vehicle. Then she drove it out to the dam and left it in the parking lot below the Hoover Dam bypass bridge. She called a cab using a prepaid cell she'd bought at a drugstore with cash, and had the driver take her back to the Strip and drop her at the Bellagio. She also paid him cash. She took another cab home and got there before he returned. She knew he was going to be out late. She could barely sleep that night. She was too nervous, worried about what might go wrong. Very early the next morning, she drove back out there, taking U.S. 93 south from Las Vegas, tense behind the wheel, and parked her car in the same lot below the bypass bridge. When she saw her getaway car at the other end of the parking lot, waiting for her, it suddenly felt real for the first time. She left her wallet with all her ID in the glove compartment. Then she went to the bridge. There were a few people around, enough to be sure that she was seen. She stood at the guardrail and looked down. It was about a 900-foot drop to the Colorado River below. She felt dizzy at the view. Jumping or falling would mean certain death. She took out her cell phone and snapped a picture. Then she sent the picture, along with a text, to him. "You can't hurt me anymore. This is it. And it's on you." Once the message was sent, she flung the cell phone off the bridge. After that, she had to act quickly. She left the bridge, went down to the parking area, and stepped into one of the portable toilets when nobody was looking. Inside, she quickly stripped off everything but her bra and panties. She had a sundress in her pack, which she slipped over her head, then put on the sandals with heels she'd also brought. She bundled her shorts, t-shirt, sneakers, and baseball cap into her pack, then let her hair down and put on big sunglasses. She pulled out a small compact and applied lipstick. Except for the pack she was carrying, she looked completely different. Farther down the parking lot, her second-hand car was waiting, with her expensive new ID as Karen Fairfield in the glove compartment. She had on her whatever cash she'd managed to save. She walked across the lot to her getaway car, the sundress swirling around her bare legs, feeling like she could almost fly. She got in the car, put the windows down, and started driving. And with every mile, she started to breathe a little easier.
"I saw you coming up the walk," Bridget says, opening her door. "Come on in."
Bridget's obviously happy to see her, and for a moment everything seems like it used to. Karen wishes she could confide in Bridget about the mess she's in. How much easier this would be if she could share her burden with someone else. But she must keep her secret, even from her closest friend. And her husband. Because she doesn't know what she might have done the night of the accident. The two of them head automatically to the kitchen at the back, out of habit.
"I was just putting on a pot of coffee. Do you want some? It's decaf."
"Sure." Karen sits down in the seat she usually takes at Bridget's kitchen table and watches her as she prepares the coffee.
"How are you feeling?"
Bridget asks, glancing at her over her shoulder.
"Better," Karen says. "You look good, considering," Bridget says.
Karen smiles ruefully. It feels good to pretend, even briefly, that life is what it used to be. She touches her face gingerly. The swelling has gone, and the bruises have faded and yellowed.
"I don't mean to pry, at all."
Bridget looks back at Karen over her shoulder again.
"But if you want to talk about it, I'm here. Or if you don't want to, we don't have to. I'll understand."
Karen can tell that Bridget is dying to talk about it.
"It's just that... it's the strangest thing. I don't remember anything about that night.
Karen lies. From the time I was making supper till I woke up in the hospital. So I don't have much to say.
That must be so weird.